everybody. Ray Lucchese here with
Keith Townsend
and Matt Leed
and Howard Marks here, but this time I'm a guest.
Welcome to the next episode of Graybridge on Storage podcast, show where we get Graybridge storage bloggers to talk with system vendors and other experts to discuss upcoming products, technologies, and trends affecting the data center or our world today. This Graybridge on Storage episode was recorded on April 23rd, 2020. We have with us here today Howard Marks, a longtime friend, former co-host, and technologist extraordinary and plenipotentiary at VAST. So Howard, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what's new at VAST?
Well, I've been around here long enough. I don't think I need to tell people much. I've been in the storage business kind of forever. But things are exciting at VAST. As you guys know, we make a large-scale, all-flash storage system for unstructured data. And we've been selling now for about 14 months. That's been going really well. And our investors rewarded us just the other day with...
Yeah, I saw something about that. You guys got some more money, I think.
Yeah, just a little. A $100 million round at a $1.2 billion valuation. You know, I was going to go to NAB in the unicorn Aloha shirt. But then they canceled NAB. So we're, you know, so the funding part is nice, especially since we haven't spent the B round yet. So, you know, that extra $100 million is going to come in really handy in this kind of times.
Right, right. Well, it should give you plenty of runway. So I don't think we've talked with VAST before. So you mentioned unstructured data. So what exactly do you guys do again?
So I hate to remind you this, Ray, but I have been a guest before from VAST. But that aside, so we make a large-scale, all-flash scale-out system for unstructured data. So all-flash is relatively obvious. But we make systems that start at a petabyte and go up, and up extends to exabytes.
It's pretty unusual to see a petabyte of flash surround, you know, for storage these days. Is that all flash? Is it all flash?
The problem is that while other vendors might have been willing to make you a petabyte all flash storage system, nobody was able to afford it before. So VAST, you know, our founder, Renan Halleck, was the chief technical guy at Extreme.io. And as he was planning to leave, he started talking to Extreme.io customers saying, okay, so what don't you like? And nobody said, you know, this all-flash array isn't fast enough.
Yeah, I would say so.
Everybody said, this all-flash array, it costs too much for me to put all my data on, and I have to use it just for my most critical or my most performance-requiring applications. VAST was designed to bring the cost of all-flash down to the point where you could use it for things like archives without people going, are you crazy? You can't afford that.
Yeah, it's very unusual to be archiving to all-flash arrays, Howard.
It is. We're the first people who make it possible. And the secret sauce starts with QLC Flash.
Are you guys actually shipping QLC Flash?
We are. We've been shipping QLC Flash for about a year. We buy the cheapest QLC Flash SSDs. Intel makes them for a couple of the hyperscalers. Right. And so this is, they're 15.36 terabyte usable SSDs, no DRAM buffer, no power failure capacitors because they don't have the buffer that they have to protect. And that means that the QLC is basically exposed to us. And other people can't use those SSDs, first of all, because they're single-ported and most enterprise storage systems are designed for dual-port drives.
So, Howard, you're describing like my nightmare desktop setup of QLC flash with no DRAM, single-ported. That just doesn't sound like any kind of thing that I want to build a system around.
Well, it's not something you want to build a system around. It's something you want really smart guys to build a system around so that they can address all of the deficiencies of that really cheap QLC SSD that you're afraid of.
But they address it in software.
Well, there is a lot of software, but there's also a substantial amount of 3D XPoint.
Optane? And QLC?
Optane and QLC.
So you're using Intel.
We are using Intel Optane SSDs. We're using Intel QLC SSDs because they like us, not because we're locked into that. And the Optane acts as a write buffer.
All the data is only stored on QLC other than during writes?
Yes.
How are you guys sound like a walking commercial for Optane memory?
If you look at how other storage vendors use Optane, it looks very much like what other storage vendors were doing in 2009, 2010 with flash SSDs.
Right.
It's, you know, oh, look here, we have this faster thing. We can use it as a cache. We have this faster thing. We can use it as a tier. And we already have tiering software because we wrote that 10 years ago when flash SSDs came out. We are the first vendors to really look at 3D Crosspoint and say, how is this fundamentally different? So give me about 3 minutes to run through some architectural points. So we disaggregate the compute part of a storage system from the media. The compute part runs in software on x86 servers and connects to the media over NVMe over fabrics.
The back end is NVMe over fabric?
The back end is NVMe over fabrics.
Ethernet?
Usually 100 gig Ethernet. For HPC customers, we run InfiniBand because they like to integrate into their InfiniBand network. So
Sorry to interrupt.
The media is stored in an HA enclosure. There's two fabric modules that each have 200 gig Ethernet ports that route NVMe over fabrics requests to the SSDs in the enclosure. There's 12 Optane SSDs and 44 QLC SSDs in each enclosure.
It's Optane SSDs, not Optane memory?
It's Optane SSDs because we talk to them over NVMe over fabrics. Optane DIMMs are local to the CPU that the DIMM slot is in. Right? We have disaggregated everything and we share everything. And you can't share a DIMM. You can with software and maybe with like Gen Z 3 years from now. But you really can't share a DIMM.
So you got this controller, 2 controllers, 10 controllers, scale out controllers.
Scale out front end servers. You can call them controllers. They do a little bit more, but controller's a good enough term. Every front end server mounts over NVMe over fabrics every SSD in the cluster at boot time.
Wait, hold on. Let me, because the scaling problem is coming directly into my head when I hear you say that. How many front-end servers?
An arbitrary number we've tested.
An arbitrary number. Let's just say
2 to N, apparently. You don't do a one, right?
No. So we won't sell you one because performance is primarily dictated by the CPU. You know, there's so much performance in the back end that how much CPU provides is the primary determinant of performance, but the system will run on one. So in failure modes, you get degraded performance all the way down to, I started with 20 and now there's only one.
So I'm kind of taken back about the each front end mounts every SSD, because I was going to ask you about this, data locality challenge from the front end to the back end, but you're telling me that every SSD is mounted by every front end server.
Every SSD is mounted by every front end server, which means that every bit of data is equally local to every front end server.
So these guys are smarter than me because this is, that's crazy, Howard.
Metadata locking across 25,000 front end servers to, 44 SSDs.
We have not tested 25,000, but for 100.
100 servers?
So 100 front end servers connect to, 100 front end servers in a typical arrangement would be 400 or 500 SSDs on the back end.
We're going to find the gotcha in this because there's a gotcha somewhere. So okay. We're going to find it.
So let me fill you in on a couple of other pieces and you can see if a gotcha shows up.
All right.
Okay.
So the front end servers, the controllers, are stateless. There's no metadata cache. They simply process requests and do all the compute. So they manage the data protection and the reduction and all of that stuff. But all the metadata is stored in the 3D crosspoint. So if you write a file via NFS or next month via SMB, the front end server creates that file in the metadata structures in the 3D crosspoint so that all of the metadata is equally available to all of the front end servers.
All right. So that's starting to make a little sense to me. So I have low latency access to the 3D crosspoint SSDs. Everyone has equal access over this 100 gigabit Ethernet or
InfiniBand.
Or InfiniBand if I need super low latency.
It's usually more InfiniBand because I already use InfiniBand.
100 server trying to create files at the same time to a single metadata data set? Is that kind of the world?
A distributed metadata data set, but not a dedicated metadata service or server like you'd have in like Lustre.
So you would distribute the metadata across all the Optanes, let's say 100 Optanes in this 400 SSD configuration?
Yeah.
So is it writing to those? I know we keep sidetracking you, Howard. But is it writing to those Optanes simultaneously, or is it replicating across a given server set?
So when a front-end server makes a metadata modification or writes new data to the write buffer, it writes immediately to two Optanes in two enclosures before it considers it written. It isn't primary, secondary.
So it's three Optane versions of this metadata or two?
Two.
Okay.
So Howard, the let's talk about metadata management, because something at the end of the day, some CPU has to manage the metadata. It has to optimize it, et cetera, et cetera. It's a database deal.
Yeah, it's B-tree based, and the trees are designed to be, so there's a B-tree, we call it a V-tree, but that aside, there's a V-tree for every object, you know, file or S3 object. And that tree is a maximum of 7 layers deep. So any lookup to find, you know, where's this piece of data is a maximum of 7 queries to the metadata base. But since every element has its own tree, having hundreds of front ends, unless they're all accessing the same file, they're not fighting over the same metadata objects. They're just dealing with the same set of metadata.
Yeah, but I still have to perform like database. It's still a database, and I still have to perform database maintenance on this.
B-trees, maybe not. Yeah.
Not really more than maintaining the tree for any given file at any given time.
Yeah, but you know, so if 100 servers with 500 and 400 SSDs and 100 Optanes, how does the traffic cop work in this thing? I'm going to access a file A. Which one of those 100 servers do I go to?
Those front end servers have a pool of virtual IP addresses.
A pool, okay.
And round robin DNS assigns you to one of those front end servers.
So there's a round robin DNS in front of this thing?
Yeah.
And is a Mellanox switch or something like that behind it?
So we use Mellanox switches primarily today. Mellanox is an investor. We're also qualifying other switches because it's 100 gig Ethernet.
So in theory, each client is only writing to one of those metadata handlers.
Well, I'm a Windows guy, so I'll think SMB, not NFS, but I could have drives mapped to different names that point to different front end servers, but any one connection is going to go to one front end server.
Hmm. And continue to that, use that server until it's a failure or something like that.
Right.
This is really cool, but I'm going to ask the obvious question. Why do I even want this?
So you want this because the current class of scale-out systems doesn't fit your needs. So, you know, we haven't today talked about how we have a new class of erasure codes that gives you N+4 protection with 3% overhead, or about how we have a new class of data reduction that we guarantee reduces data better than anybody else's.
What? N+4 with only 3% overhead?
146+4. Now, Ray laughs at 146+4 because you're thinking of Reed Solomon erasure codes. And if we did 146+4 with Reed Solomon, when a drive failed, we'd have to read from 145 drives. If two drives fail, then it gets, and then it's, you know, then it's everything. For one drive failure, I just have to read the first parity. We use a new class of erasure codes called locally decodable codes. And what locally decodable means is that in order to rebuild, we only need to read 1/4 of the surviving data strips and all 4 protection strips. So we have to read 37 data strips to rebuild, not 145 data strips to rebuild.
Still, I mean, 37 is a good large number of data that's going to be consumed during a rebuild, right? I mean, these are 15 terabytes, was 15.4-ish kind of?
Yeah, 15.4-ish. But if you, so there, in order to have 146+4, you have 4 enclosures, which means you probably have 24 or more front-end servers. And the rebuild process is distributed across all the front-end servers. Each one rebuilds one RAID stripe at a time. So if there were a million RAID stripes that hit the failed SSD, though, that's a million rebuild jobs distributed across all the front-end servers.
I was thinking you were going to actually assign like one of the 37 drives that are remaining to one of the front-end servers, but you're doing it horizontally, not vertically.
We're doing it horizontally. Everything parallelizes out, and it's a fail-in-place architecture. We don't have spare drives. It's not a many-to-one rebuild. It's a many-to-many rebuild. We just use spare space across the cluster.
Let's go one layer deeper if there is another layer deeper.
Oh, you know me. There's always another layer deeper.
There's another layer deeper. We're dealing with some pretty stupid drives here. These QLC drives are pretty dumb.
Yes.
How do you guys mitigate the stupidity of the drives when it comes to data integrity, et cetera? Because I'm writing to QLC, and I don't trust QLC.
First of all, let me talk about the endurance part for a second. And you can tell me how geeky you want me to get. I'll start with not very geeky. The spec sheet for these drives?
Was that 2 writes per year or something like that?
Well, it's 0.2 drive writes per day if you write 4K random IOs. But it's 4 drive writes per day, 20 times as much if you write 128K sequential IOs.
So you're right, sequential, obviously. Okay.
So we use the 3D crosspoint as a write buffer, and we accumulate very large amounts of data before we start migrating it to the QLC. We created this system to use stupid SSDs. You know, I'll tell you guys a little secret. The plan called for using the open format SSDs where the controller's responsible for flash translation. And turns out those are more expensive, so we use these other stupid SSDs.
Don't have any translation on board?
Well, they do.
But you don't use it.
But we are aware of the internal structures, and so we always write big writes that are a multiple of the page size of the flash so that we never create page tears and force the SSD to garbage collect.
So what's the chances of overrunning the Optane write buffer?
So there's 3 terabytes of Optane write buffer per enclosure. And the odds of overwriting it are nil because the process that sucks the data out of that write buffer runs faster than the process that pushes the data into that write buffer. So we can drain the buffer faster than we can fill it.
So how many SSDs are we talking per enclosure? Is it 40?
44 and 12.
44 and 12. And you're saying that you can actually empty the Optane faster than you can fill it?
Yes.
Now, emptying the Optane means reading it into something and writing out to a QLC SSD, right?
So we now do encryption at rest.
Encryption at rest, okay.
And so that means that the migration process means reading data. And so, another trick. So the whole idea in maximizing the endurance of the QLC layer is to minimize how much garbage collection happens, both within the system and within the SSD. So when we write new data to the system, we evaluate its life expectancy. If it's a temp file or getting written to a temp folder or other things, then we say this is going to be ephemeral data. It's not going to last very long.
It's hard to do that sort of determination on the fly.
It is, but we don't have to be perfect. If we are pretty good at predicting the life expectancy of the data, and we write erasure coding stripes that contain just data we expect to be ephemeral, come garbage collection time, however percentage we were right, that stripe is going to be empty because that data was ephemeral and it was deleted and overwritten, which means we only have to garbage collect a very small amount of data. And that means that we create less write amplification on the back end. And of course, the data that we move, we go, you've survived long enough to be garbage collected. Your life expectancy is now in a higher class, because you've made it past infant mortality.
Yeah. And a stripe in this kind of world is like you're saying 146 plus 4, right? Or something like that. It may be max, right?
It's 36. So in one enclosure, there's 44 SSDs. So we stripe 36 plus 4 is 40, which leaves us 4 SSDs worth of space to rebuild to. And then we rotate the stripes so that, it's distributed RAID. And then as you add enclosures, the stripes get wider.
It's even so, 36 of these 128 kilobyte large block sizes time.
Well, we write 1 megabyte.
So it's 36 meg, let's say.
For a substripe.
And then there's 40 with the plus 4.
No. On each SSD, one front-end server writes 1 meg substripes. And we write a 1 gig deep stripe on each SSD of data with the same life expectancy. So that when we garbage collect, we're doing the erase at 1 gigabyte per SSD, because the erase block size in this QLC flash is 200 megabytes-ish. So we're erasing a multiple of the erase block size and, again, reducing the write amplification inside the SSD.
So in theory, let's bring that higher to like standard operating and drive replacement. I shouldn't have this very sudden use of, a whole block of SSDs going out, because you guys have kind of planned that usage pretty well.
Well, we will replace any failed SSD for any reason at any time on any system under maintenance. And we will write you a maintenance contract for up to 10 years, and we'll write extensions to shorter contracts up to 10 years at a flat rate.
Not many storage vendors out there offer 10 years of maintenance at a whack.
We have a government customer who bought a 10-year service contract.
I'm impressed.
The part of the new economic model is that you can leave this on your floor for 10 years. It's an all-flash system. It's unlikely you're going to have performance drivers saying, well, the new thing is so fast, we have to replace this old thing in 5 or 6 years. But if your vendor says, I'll only, you know, in year six, your maintenance becomes so high, you might as well buy a new system. Then over a 10-year period, you actually end up migrating twice. And there's that means there's 2 years where if you're a typical sloppy enterprise, well, it takes a year from the day the new system comes in till the day the old system goes out. And so you're paying for two systems for two of those 10 years. So the economics of I didn't have to have my guys do a migration, I didn't have to buy a new system, I didn't have to run two systems at the same time, that starts to add up pretty quick.
You mentioned somewhere earlier about this world-class data reduction, better, best in the world, kind of. I'm not sure what the term was.
Guaranteed better data reduction than any other storage system.
So how does one do that with, you know, these data reduction systems have been out there for years?
A whole new idea.
Really? You don't write the data?
Well, no, we do write the data, but we don't do conventional deduplication.
What?
All right, that needs to be explained, Howard.
In a conventional system, you've got compression, which takes very small repetitions in the incoming data and finds them and replaces them with symbols.
Shorter symbols, I might add, but go ahead. Right.
Deduplication finds larger exact duplicates and replaces them with pointers. We use a technique that's based on similarity. So like deduplication, we break the data up into chunks. And we use variable chunk sizes with the same technique that the RockSoft patent covers so that insertions don't throw us off. But rather than hashing that block with a strong collision-resistant hash function like SHA-1 that's designed to have a large change in the hash function output for a small change in the data input, we use a hash function that generates the same output if the two blocks are sufficiently similar or are sufficiently close in cryptographic distance.
Similarity like that is the problem. If I've got a block where I've written and I've updated it with a block that's two characters different, I want both those blocks to be saved, Howard.
Yeah, we're not throwing one away, Ray. I told you, we're not doing deduplication. But what similar means is those two blocks dedupe with the same compression dictionary because only two bytes are different. So all of those repetitions and symbols are the same. So we store, when the first block we see comes in that generates a given hash, we compress it and we store it, and it becomes a reference block. When the second block generates the same hash, we compress the two blocks together and save the difference.
Huh? What do you mean compress it together? The first block is already compressed.
Right.
The second block comes in and it hashes to the similar hash.
Right. And then we compress it alongside the first block using the first block's dictionary. We don't have to save the dictionary a second time.
Huffman encoding kind of thing? Is that what HuffPuff kind of thing?
We also do Huffman encoding. But this is more about the LZ phase than the Huffman phase. So we use Zstandard, Facebook's new compression algorithm. That means compression algorithms just keep getting better in various ways. And Zstandard is very good at the degree of compression for the amount of compute that it needs.
Yeah, that's always the problem, right? Compression demands so much horsepower to run effectively.
And the hash itself is not cheap either.
For most systems, the problem is time. That, you know, if you're doing real-time, if you're doing inline reduction, then it has to be fast because you're affecting the write latency. And if you have NVRAM write buffer, it's only a few gigabytes. It's small. You have to be really worried about draining it all the time. And again, that means you don't have much time and you can't do really extensive compression. Once data is written to our Optane layer, we acknowledge the write. the migration process from the Optane to the QLC is asynchronous. And that means that it, as long as we can have enough bandwidth draining the Optane layer so that it doesn't overflow, the time it takes to move any piece of data from Optane to QLC and erasure code it and compress it and encrypt it doesn't really matter. And since we can scale compute by adding more front-end servers independently of scaling capacity in the enclosures, and frankly, front-end servers are cheap. They're just standard x86 servers. Our software is licensed on the enclosure. So if you want more front-end servers, you're just buying hardware. And how much CPU it takes to compress becomes a function of how much hardware, you know, whether that's creates a performance problem or there's not enough CPU to do other things problem is a scaling issue. You throw more, a little bit more cheap hardware at it.
You mentioned encryption at rest somewhere back in my memory here.
Yeah, new feature in next week's announcements.
So encryption at rest is going to affect compression, deduplication, data reduction, and all that other stuff, right?
We encrypt last.
I understand you encrypt last, but the hash is not okay. I got it. So your hash is sitting there in the metadata associated with the block, I guess.
The hash is the hash and which reference block it points to, and the CRC are all in the metadata that points to.
So two blocks that happen to be similar could be two distinct files. They don't even have to be close to one another. And they get encrypted with the same key, I guess? It's not like a volume level encryption or a pool?
It's system-wide encryption.
It's system-wide, I see.
You say encrypt my data at rest and all the data in the system is encrypted. Selective encryption and data reduction is an interesting problem. Not one I have spent a huge amount of time considering.
So Howard, that brings me back to this point of kind of work management across, let's say that we have 10 front-end servers.
Right.
While the servers themselves are stateless, the work is not stateless. Like if I'm in the middle of doing, if one of the nodes is in the middle of doing encryption and then it fails, or encryption is being done across a certain number of nodes and that fails, where is that state maintained? Because while the servers themselves are stateless, there is still state.
There's always state. The state's always the key to our system is the state's in the enclosure where another server can pick it up. So let me answer your question and give you another example. Every update to our system is transactional. And so migrating a substripe from Optane to QLC is a transactional process. And so we create a transaction token and indicate progress on that and keep track of progress on that transaction. If the front end server died in the middle of migrating a stripe, the data is all still in the 3D crosspoint. The transaction didn't complete. It gets aborted, and moving that data gets assigned to another VAST server, which starts migrating the data. There may be some data that got written to the QLC that's going to get written to the QLC again, and it will occupy a little bit of space until we garbage collect.
So there's some, so obviously I'm keeping this tracking on the 3D cross point, and there's some worker daemon on each node looking at that.
Yeah, they're not logs, but yes. So let me give you a little more complicated example. SMB. Right. NFS and S3, the first protocols we implemented, are stateless. Every request is independent. But SMB is very stateful because SMB does things like opportunistic locking, where a node caches data that it's reading and tells the server, I have this data cached. And if some other user updates that data, the server sends a message, says invalidate your cache for this because somebody changed it. That requires that the SMB server have a huge amount of state about every SMB client connection. In everybody else's scale-out NAS running SMB 2.1, if a node fails, that state is lost and the user has to reconnect. Because we store that state in the 3D crosspoint, when a node in our system fails, one of the other nodes picks up that virtual IP address and picks up the state, and the client retries within the SMB timeout, and the user never noticed that anything went wrong. So yeah, the system has state. The front-end servers don't have state. And compared to something like an Isilon or some other scale-out system that's shared nothing, that means failures of the front-end server nodes don't cause a rebuild event because there's nothing that they were exclusive owners of.
I'm having trouble visualizing.
We need a whiteboard or something like that for our podcast, but that would be a different domain.
So this goes back to that argument that me, Matt, and Ray had over Kubernetes and state. So in a stateless, truly stateless system, which the VAST system seems like is a truly stateless system, at least on the front end, not the system, but the nodes are stateless.
Yeah, the system is very stateful. Any storage system is stateful, but the front end servers are stateless.
Yeah, the system is stateful, but how you maintain that state is based on the underlying processes on the storage system itself. So that how would I approve this? Now go back and teach Kubernetes guys how to do this.
I'm just a storage guy. All I know about Kubernetes is that we have a CSI and it works great.
Okay, well, talk to me about, do you guys do snapshots and replication and mirroring and across systems and all that stuff?
So, you know, as you guys know, we're a startup, and so you come out with a product that meets the needs of some customers. We're making our real push into what you would think of as enterprise users with the release that comes out at the end of April that includes SMB support and a snap to S3 function so that you can take snapshots and replicate that data to S3 and have offsite backups. And we just treat remote backup, remote snapshots like a special class of snapshots. So there's a .vast remote folder you can browse to restore a file from them, and encryption at rest. So those features are, you know, just coming out.
And you guys already support S3, right, as an object protocol?
Yeah, we've supported NFS and S3 from day one. All of our protocols are in-house development. We don't use Samba or MoSMB or anything like that, because all that state stuff I was just describing, and the failover only works because we've tied SMB so tightly to the disaggregated shared everything architecture. Because we've had the SMB server store its state in Crosspoint, we can do the failover.
Yeah, we're going to have to get you on a different podcast and talk about the networking part of this, because I have a bunch of networking questions about that back end. Even if it's NVMe over Fabric, there is still the process of moving the packets in and off the network at a latency and pace perspective that makes sense. So there's still a lot there to unpack.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can tell, you know, some of this isn't going to be out for a little while, but I can tell you that we bottlenecked at the PCIe slot. We ran out of lanes.
On the back end or the front end?
In the back end.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive because, you know, as you talk about DPDK and all the technologies needed to move at line rate, just in general, to say that that the bottleneck is PCIe, you guys are doing some pretty special stuff to optimize the code to get the packets on and off and reduce that latency. It'll be pretty interesting to see what you guys are doing.
I'd be glad to sit down with you, Keith.
Well, you have to sit down with all of us.
We might move it to the CTO advisor so we can do the whiteboard part.
All right, gentlemen, this has been great. Keith and Matt, any last questions for Howard before we close?
I would ask Howard, how do you feel about working on the vendor side? What's the change in
besides paycheck?
The steady paycheck's a nice thing. The health insurance is a nice thing. I am still learning how to make everything I say be bright and sunny because I'm a marketing guy. But, it all works. It's a good team. You know, I took a job because I was getting lonely and wanted to work with a team, and I'm very happy with this team. And, you know, it's a great story to tell. The technology is unique. We're doing things nobody else does. I mean, if you look at, you know, so we talked about the similarity data reduction. But if you look at the systems, we don't compete with pure flash array or solid fire. We compete with Isilon and Spectrum Scale, GPFS, and Lustre. And on those systems, data protection's been, data reduction's been, yeah, you could compress your data in the cold tier, but we don't recommend it for anything with performance. Or, we dedupe, but it's a background job, and you have to make sure that the background job doesn't run when your users are busy, because it consumes a lot of the system performance. We're data reduction all the time over tens or hundreds of petabytes of data, and people have had problems getting that stuff to scale before. And again, having all the metadata in the 3D crosspoint means we don't have the usual dedupe problem of, does that hash table fit in memory?
Interesting. Keith, anything you'd like to ask?
Well, I'll just leave it off with the comment. It looks pretty cool. The solution's pretty cool. I'll have to talk to my friends at Intel to see if I can get them to sponsor putting one of those in my data center for a little bit.
Yeah, let me know. I'd like to get a hands on myself.
Yeah, I think we can make an argument for it, guys.
Yeah.
With our standard enclosure being 675 terabytes of raw capacity.
Ouch.
Home labs are not really a
target. Yeah, I don't have a home lab, Howard. You know, I'm in a 450,000 square foot data center, so I think I can manage it.
Yeah, I understand. I was the guy who had more than a home lab for a long time.
Yeah, there you go. Howard, anything you'd like to say to our listening audience before we close?
Yeah, I think that, you know, our listening audience should be watching VAST, because even if you're not in the large scale that we operate in, we're doing interesting things and taking a new approach to doing storage. And somebody will follow along and go, that was a good idea. What happens if you try and scale that down?
Exactly.
Well, this has been great. Thank you very much, Howard, for being on our show today.
Always a pleasure, guys. I miss being a graybeard.
Well, you're still a graybeard, but you're not a graybeard on storage graybeard. Next time, we will talk to another system storage technology person. Any questions you want us to ask, please let us know. And if you enjoy our podcast, tell your friends about it. And please review us on iTunes and Google Play, as this will help get the word out. That's it for now. Bye, Keith. Bye, Matt.
Bye, Ray.
Bye, Ray.
And bye, Howard.
Bye, Ray.
Bye.